Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, NFL Week 3. And what an interesting slate we have on tap this Sunday. I am your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider. And Payne, we got a tandem of Monday Night Football games this past week, and we got 0.0 snaps of actual drama in the twin bill.
Your eyes did not deceive you. That's what the scoreboard indicated. You are spot on there, sir.
You know, pretty incredible.
You looking for some analysis?
No, no.
Is that what you're hoping
Actually,
for?
You know what? I was looking for a bit of analysis because I watched the first half of that Eagles-Vikings game. Thought we were going to be in for a treat. Irv Smith drops a ball that looked like it fell from the heavens into his hands. And then we watch old Kirk Cousins rear his ugly head with multiple bad interceptions and wilt like a pumpkin under the pressure of that Philadelphia defense when they were protecting a 2+ score lead.
Not a good second half. That first interception on the opening drive did allow me to go to bed a little bit sooner. Let's just put it that way. So
you and Ryan Tannehill might have been able to go to bed at about the exact same time on the East Coast. As far as the Titans are concerned, I mean, is this what we're going to see from Tennessee going forward, or is that more just a sign of the Bills having a different gear that they can take into a next level if you give them an inch of separation?
So we didn't really like the matchup. That was evident, right? We mentioned how we played the Bills on the look-ahead line. We broke down that game in its entirety and said, if you can't run, then what? You can't really play action a team that plays that much zone. And we saw all of those things unfold. It was just a really poor matchup. Taylor Lewan goes down early. That looks like a season ender. You know, Harold Landry is a versatile chess piece on defense. He's not there. There's a lot of things that are going wrong with the Tennessee Titans. And this was a team that we thought over the last couple of years didn't really have the talent, but Vrabel kind of schemed them to some victories that otherwise we didn't believe they should have had. Like, this is just a team that's been an overachiever for many years. And now all of a sudden the talent's starting to dwindle a little bit, and you're seeing what the Tennessee Titans truly are. And again, this was a full-blown fade in this offseason. This was a win total that opened 9.5. Professional bettors faded the crap out of the Titans. Still were fading them at under 9 leading up to the start of the season. So this is not all that surprising right now.
It's a team, when you look at them and their philosophy this offseason, not just drafting Malik Willis, because I think that became a value proposition when he fell to them, but not making a long-term commitment to A.J. Brown, told us a lot about where they feel they are as an organization and a potential rebuild that may be looming without necessarily saying as much. The interesting part for the Titans, though, they play in arguably the worst division in the entire National Football League from top to bottom in terms of parity, and so we'll see if that keeps them afloat for a lot longer than they should, given the Colts early season struggles. The Jaguars, the only team with a victory of the quartet of AFC South sides. But all right,
is it feasible that division as a whole is worse than we could have ever imagined? We knew it was probably the worst division in football, but now the ringleaders are not very good. The one team that we did see a buy signal for was the Jacksonville Jaguars. Probably deserved better in their opener. Could be 2-0, showing some promise there. But aside from that, not very good out of that division.
I mean, the Jaguars are interesting. I mean, it's not a school of thought we necessarily ascribe to in trying to take ridiculous prices during the offseason, but I knew there were some bettors that were gravitating towards the Jags at long shot numbers to win the division. Suddenly, that's a position that you have as you look at the Jags right around 3-1 to win the South that you could scalp for a profit after just two games. Not necessarily a ringing endorsement for Doug Peterson and company through two data points, but maybe more indicative of the rest of the division and some of the struggles they'll have. But that's enough discussion discussion of the AFC South. I don't want to get sick 3 minutes into this podcast and talk about teams that we don't care all that much about, at least right now. But unfortunately, we have no choice as we go to Thursday Night Football, where we get to see the Cleveland Browns, 72 hours or so after the wake of a collapse against the New York Jets, play host to the anemic offense of the Pittsburgh Steelers. Cleveland, 4.5-point home favorite. Total in this game has come down a shade from where it opened at 40.5 into that 38.5 range. And when you look at these two teams, interesting seasons to date. Both teams have had all of their games this year decided by 3 points or less. The Steelers' point differential through two games, zero. The Browns' point differential through two games, +1. Meanwhile, the Steelers are now 0-5 without TJ Watt since he was drafted. But Mike Tomlin and how he has performed within the division as an underdog, some of those numbers are hard to ignore, and I'll lay those out first, Payne, before we get into some of the X's and O's. Mike Tomlin, 24-6-1 straight up versus the Browns during his coaching career. Tied for the third most wins in any NFL matchup over this span since 2007. Mike Tomlin, 19-6-2 against the spread in his career as a divisional underdog. Mike Tomlin overall as an underdog, 43-23-2 as a divisional dog of 3-plus points, 13-3-1. And Kevin Stefanski has not openly embraced oddsmaker expectations. He's 0-6 against the spread as head coach of the Cleveland Browns in his career as a divisional favorite. They're 5-1 straight up in those games. They just can't win them by more than 5 points. And in divisional games where your bread is buttered if you want to be a divisional champion, 1-11 against the spread and just 6-6 straight up. Never a great sign if you're having a team meeting 2 weeks into the season. But here we are with the Cleveland Browns. And honestly, Payne, I don't care which side of the ball you want to attack here, because it's strength on weakness for both defenses against their offensive counterparts.
Jacoby Brissett is interesting to me because, you know, he played arguably his best game as a pro week two. Completion percentage was off the charts, right? 11% over expectation. He was the third best QB of the week in both passing success rate and EPA per pass. Then he added another 43 yards on the ground. And your hope was that, at least as a Browns fan, you could tread water until Watson returns. And it looks like that division might not be as good as we initially thought, with the Bengals free falling and Baltimore still having a rash of injuries. But you can't blow games at home as a 6.5-point favorite when Jacoby Brissett plays that well. He's supposed to be what Cleveland has to overcome. And that's what makes this team a little bit interesting to me. Now, short week, home game, typically advantage to the home team, but it's only a 2-hour drive, so that lightens the load for Pittsburgh. I think anybody that plays this version of Cleveland should sell out to stop the run, obviously. Make Jacoby Brissett beat you, even though he's coming off that great game. But he's dealing with a little bit of an ankle issue. You couple that with what's going on right now with the weather. 21-mile-per-hour winds in the forecast as we record, 35-mile-per-hour gusts. It's why we've seen this total dip from 40.5 to 38.5. So if you're forcing a slightly dinged up Brissett with 20-mile-per-hour winds to beat you, you're doing that to stop the run. To this point, the Steelers' defense is fourth in opponent yards before contact per rush on early downs. That's pretty good. Second EPA per rush. There's just two data points. And we know New England's struggled a little bit with their outside zone concepts they're trying to implement this season. But you like to see that out of Pittsburgh, because they had trouble stopping the run last season. They were horrific there. But it does look like Cleveland's going to get back their starting tackle, Jack Conklin. That's huge. Let's keep an eye on Joel Bitonio and Chris Hubbard. Those guys are a little bit banged up. To me, there's been this, when you think about this game, you're thinking about it in a phone booth. And that's kind of where Cleveland wants to live. And that's not necessarily what Pittsburgh's strength was last season. It's not what its strength is on all parts of this field. It's really just an interesting game here. But ultimately, we've seen a battle on this side. You know, Browns -3 was the bet early on in the week. And again, it was kind of with the idea of this being played in the phone booth, right? Cleveland's got the better run game, better run defense on paper, especially when you factor in some of the priors, which are still doing week three into the season. And then all of a sudden, with the total coming down to 38, the points became more valuable. We peaked at the Browns -5.5, and suddenly guys look down at their power ratings and they're saying, like, well, shit here, right? I only made Cleveland 1.5 on a neutral. Tack on some home field advantage, maybe you get to 3 flat. I should probably be value betting Pittsburgh +5. And so that's kind of why we're settled here at four. There was an initial position on the Browns. There were some value buys on Pittsburgh at that point. I don't know where we trend from here, but we didn't really get the best Thursday evening game. And now you're again dealing with this weather situation. We've seen what the weather looks like in Cleveland the last few seasons when the wind starts gusting. I mean, those games have been absolutely ugly.
Yeah, I mean, we don't get the best game, at least on paper. Obviously, the implications and ramifications here are relatively big when you consider all four of these teams haven't exactly played their best football. You have a trio of teams at 1-1, the Bengals picking up the rear at 0-2, so we'll see one of these sides will get through week three at 2-1, and for both of them, the Browns obviously dealing with life without Deshaun Watson and a Steelers team trying to figure out what their identity was going to be. But you would know it by reading some of the beat reporters and the buzz in and around Pittsburgh. I mean, they want to get rid of Mitchell Trubisky. They want to get rid of Matt Canada. And suddenly this team could have two wins in their first three games if they're able to figure it out today. You talked a little bit about Cleveland's willingness and desire to play in a phone booth. What's interesting, for all the struggles that the Steelers had defending the run last year, they actually had some success against Nick Chubb. I mean, they held him largely in check to just 60 rushing yards per game compared to how Chubb performed against other opponents and how porous that Steelers defense was. When you look at Pittsburgh offensively, I mean, clearly Mitchell Trubisky knows the criticism is there. The receivers are speaking out, claiming they're open and he's not getting them the ball. But what I found most interesting about Trubisky's comments this week, he's talked about his unwillingness to run and how that may need to be an important element of what they're going to do today, especially with the weather.
It seems like there's a lot of finger pointing going on here. It's not just at Trubisky either, right? You've had Deontay Johnson and Claypool and all those guys call out Matt Canada as well for the Steelers offense being too predictable with route concepts and not letting Mitch throw to all parts of the field. And to a degree, they're all right. I mean, you look at Mitch's numbers on 71 pass attempts this season. He's thrown just four passes between the hashes past the line of scrimmage. So defenses are squatting wide. And, you know, I get it. It's been, I think you kind of want to like calm people down a little bit, right? Like it's the Bengals defense. It's Belichick the first 2 weeks. Those are very tough schemes to go against. But you are looking at a fan base that's a little bit upset of what they're seeing because Pittsburgh's dead last in yards per drive. And Canada's not really coddling Mitch either, right? Pittsburgh's early down pass rate is actually 2% over expectation, which probably surprises some people. So it's not like we're getting this obnoxious amount of inefficient early down runs. Now, when Pittsburgh does run, it's inefficient, but it's not been, you know, just a ton of just handing it off up the middle and just praying. Right now, Pittsburgh 28th in line yards created. Najee Harris clearly isn't 100%. Pittsburgh's averaging 2.8 yards per rush on first down. That's dead last in the NFL. They're 29th in first down rush efficiency overall. You had last week Najee Harris total 10 yards total before first contact. So the offensive line just continues to be horrific. There's only one guy that's starting that actually has a respectable run block grade. I'm not sure how much you can fix in three off days, one of which is a travel day. But I think the positive is like Cleveland's defensive line, we talked about this coming into the season, doesn't have a ton of depth. That could be a factor in a short week. Both Clowney and Winovich have been ruled out. So two guys out of the front seven for Cleveland's defense. Both are plus edge setters. And you go back to last season where, you know, the parts are virtually the same for both of these units in the matchup. Cleveland was the one defense Pittsburgh was actually able to run against. 49% rushing success rate during the two meetings, seven explosive runs, 4.9 yards per rush. Pittsburgh needs to continue that in this matchup because they're the least explosive passing offense in the NFL. And again, going back to the win situation, I think you hit this perfectly. Mitch needs to get the legs going early and often, have that become an extension of the ground game, build some confidence with him. That's what we always see with mobile quarterbacks. There's very few of them that are the most accurate, most efficient passers. Obviously, Lamar Jackson's a different breed right now, the way he's passing the ball. But in general, we've always talked about these mobile quarterbacks, getting them going early to build the confidence in the throw game. And I think that's what we need to see tonight.
Get him out there. Let him take a hit. Let him feel the game. It'll come to him. And I think Mitchell Trubisky has to just cut it loose. I mean, you have nothing to lose right now. You understand that Kenny Pickett is waiting in the wings. So if If you don't go out there and perform, you may as well put your best foot forward and give it the old college try before you potentially lose your job. So we'll see exactly what we get from two teams that don't have quarterbacks they necessarily love or feel comfortable relying on in tight game situations. A short field, an offensive miscue, a number of things could play a role in determining a winner there. For a game that we don't think will have offense on Thursday night, to a game that could have plenty of fireworks on Sunday afternoon, down in your neck of the woods, where the Miami Dolphins will play host to the Buffalo Bills. Total in this game sits at 52 and a half. You're looking at Buffalo right now, more or less, a six-point favorite on the road. The Bills, they've won seven straight games against Miami. Six of those seven wins have been by 10-plus points, and they've gone 4-2-1 against the spread in those seven. They're one win shy of tying the longest streak from any franchise versus Miami. And Josh Allen has obviously been the key driver in all of those results. 19 touchdowns to just three interceptions during that run, and when you look at the numbers, they're somewhat staggering. The Bills, points per game, more than 36 a contest. The Dolphins, meanwhile, 17.5. The Dolphins, minus 10 in the giveaway department, and passer rating, well, it's not even worth mentioning because it's so ugly in Miami's disadvantage. When you look at Buffalo, they're plus 55 point differential this season. It's the best in the NFL. Second best through two games in franchise history. The only time they were better was way back in 1981. And obviously, this is a Bills team that we've seen at its best in primetime, not once but twice offensively. But from a defensive standpoint, this, in my opinion, will be the first true test they face, because the Rams' offensive line is a lot more like Matadors than what they're going to see from the Dolphins on Sunday.
completely agree. And I think what you're seeing, and again, it's a very small sample, but through two games, Mike McDaniel has been everything we heard about for years behind the scenes. And what's the most impressive to me is he was a run game coordinator with San Francisco and then became an OC that led a run heavy offense and didn't take many deep shots. But he's already been very adaptable to the new talent. And you look at the Dolphins, they have the seventh highest pass rate the first three quarters. Miami has the fifth highest early down pass rate over expectation. Number one motion rate. Number one in early down play action rate. These are all of the things that we have pounded the table for the last few years on what good offensive coordinators do. And Mike McDaniel's doing that. So he's changed the offense to match the talent. And so far, he's just doing the Lord's work for Tua. Tua is actually number two in EPA per pass attempt. Better than the guy he's going against this week, if you can actually believe that. He's got the sixth highest completed air yards. Tua's receivers have the second highest yak through two games. That was something we mentioned, that San Francisco finished number one last year despite not taking deep shots. Miami was the inverse, right? Had the second worst yak last season. So a huge improvement there. Dolphins receivers had the worst separation last season. It's now a top five rate. So everything is different offensively. Tua has also been very effective when he's not blitzed, and the Bills defense hasn't blitzed much this season because they've done well getting natural pressure against, as you alluded to, poor offensive lines that had injuries as well against the Rams and Titans. Both those units, I thought, were regression candidates, and both those units had guys go down. I mean, Taylor Lewan left that game very early on Monday night. McDermott also hasn't wanted to expose the secondary. And we know that Bill's secondary right now is down a few key cogs. Tre'Davious White still on the PUP. Dane Jackson, Micah Hyde both left the Monday night game with assistance off the field and both spent time in the hospital. I don't see Dane Jackson playing, and that's kind of the rumor here is that, you know, a good outcome might be him returning for a playoff run. He was the Bills' number two corner. It's also difficult to envision Hyde playing, but he's certainly the likelier of the two. Let's not forget, right, Ed Oliver, Jordan Phillips, Tim Settle, all the guys that we mentioned about enhancing the Bills' interior defensive line are battling injuries. And then you factor in the spot and the situation. Monday night game that ended close to midnight, 1,400 miles of travel, so you lose a day there as well. You're now down two prep days compared to Miami. Miami's going to make Buffalo wear their dark blue jerseys. It's a 1 p.m. Sunday game. It's supposed to be 87 degrees with 84% humidity and a UV index of 9. So it's going to be interesting to see this Buffalo Bills defense. This might be a spot where they don't show as well as we think.
When you look at this game playing out on the other side of the ball, clearly Josh Allen, the rightful MVP favorite, given the gaudy numbers he's put forth through two games. We've seen him get Stephon Diggs involved, obviously three touchdowns, nearly 150 yards receiving as he tormented that Titans secondary. And Buffalo put up those crooked numbers on Monday night without the services of Gabe Davis. Isaiah McKenzie, for me, has been a little bit of a disappointment. I can't quite figure out what's going on in the Buffalo backfield, but I could say that over the last 3 years. When you assess Miami and the way they need to try and match up, we saw them struggle immensely with Lamar Jackson, his mobility. They didn't really have much of an answer for Rashad Bateman. Do the Dolphins have enough horses to at least slow down this Bills offense that seems to be a freight train headed down the tracks?
Yeah, and the thing is, we've previewed this matchup a few times in recent years, obviously being division foes, and I don't know how much will unfold differently unless Josh Boyer elects to change his defensive style in a week. And that just hasn't been the MO. The Dolphins want to be aggressive. They want to play man coverage. They want to blitz you. But it's tough to play man coverage when your number two corner, Byron Jones, is out. You're searching for answers in the slot. You compound that with Xavier Howard's production falling off a cliff. And that's the formula for having the second worst defensive pass efficiency through 2 weeks. Between Lamar and Mack, the Dolphins have allowed 57% of passes to grade successful. The other aspect of Josh Boyer's aggressive defensive style is the blitz. The Dolphins have blitzed on 40% of defensive snaps. It's the sixth highest rate in the league. The problem is 31st in pressure rate. So Boyer's sending the house. It's not hitting home. And a leaky corner group's just getting bludgeoned. Xavier Howard's contract is more valuable than some countries. And right now, he's graded out 99th. Out of 111 qualifying corners in coverage, dealing with a little bit of a groin injury this week as well. This, to me, is the big problem with Buffalo coming to town. And you know, the worries I think we had about the Bills' pass rates decreasing haven't been a reality through 2 weeks. The Bills are actually number one pass rate the first three quarters in the NFL right now. 15% early down pass rate over expectation. So things have not changed. McDermott should be happy, 2-0, but this is really an interesting offense, and I think what you're going to see if Miami continues playing these high rates of man coverage is the Bills just running a bunch of deep crossers. They're going to run some overs off play action. They're going to run pick routes. There's going to be a bunch of double moves, you name it. And Josh Allen has also been fantastic when blitzed this season. 82% adjusted accuracy, 9.5 yards per pass attempt, a 134 passer rating. Gabe Davis practiced in a limited fashion on Wednesday, so that's a positive step towards playing. He was a guy that was a game time decision Monday, so let's monitor that a little bit. But that would be a huge get back, especially if Xavier Howard's playing at less than 100%, if you had Gabe Davis to pair with Stephon Diggs.
Yeah, and I mean, Gabe Davis, the one takeaway from some of the Bills beat reporters, said he was seen around Highmark Stadium on Monday, like you said, a game time decision, but wasn't with a noticeable limp or anything else. So there was an increased level of optimism that he could be ready for a pivotal division game. And I believe the term pick route pain, unless you're talking from a defensive coordinator standpoint, it's called a rub route, all right? This is an offensive-minded football league. You have to focus on that side of the ball. Pick route carries such a negative connotation.
It does. Rubbing is offense in 2022. Can that be a thing?
I mean,
allowed to steal that from the NASCAR community?
Yeah, you know, rubbing is racing, rubbing is offense. I mean, we can try and go one way or another to try and be able to spin.
Rubbing is route running. I think that's probably better.
There are plenty of ties, obviously, from this Bills team. Not obviously impacting the handicap, but always worth noting. James Cook from Miami, Kaiir Elam from that neck of the woods, Zach Moss, Isaiah McKenzie, Jaquan Johnson, Devin Singletary, all from the South Florida area, but maybe more importantly, Greg Russo, the emerging defensive presence for the Bills, played his college ball there, and of course, offensive coordinator Ken Dorsey knows a thing or two about victories down there in South Florida, much to Payne's chagrin. All right, from the sweltering heat and humidity of the Bills-Dolphins game to a nice climate control setting in the dome at U.S. Bank Stadium, where the Minnesota Vikings will look to try and bounce back in the wake of a very disappointing performance on Monday Night Football against the Philadelphia Eagles. And it's the Vikings that find themselves installed as a 6-point favorite as they'll welcome in the Detroit Lions. Total in the game, 52. You've seen this number on the side come down a shade from where it was on the look-ahead price in that 7-7.5 range. You've seen the total tick up a shade through the key number of 51. And what I find interesting is adversity is always a better truth teller than tranquility as far as NFL teams. And for all of the accolades, the talk about the Minnesota Vikings being a viable NFC contender, those get dashed after a 23-7 win against Green Bay when you follow it up with a 24-7 loss against Philadelphia. The Lions, however, are seeking their first road win since 2020 when they beat the Chicago Bears. When you look at some of the trends here, they're fascinating. Obviously not always predictive of what you're going to see, but the Lions, been one of the best teams in the NFL when it comes to covering numbers. 13-6 against the spread since the start of last season. Looking to start 3-0 ATS for the first time since 1992. Jared Goff, 12-2 against the spread in his career as an underdog. However, it does come with a caveat, of 4+ points, 9-2 in that role with the Lions. Meanwhile, Kirk Cousins, though, he has been the model of bouncing back, 17-10 straight up off a loss, 18-9 against the spread. And I think Minnesota's offense, Payne, probably the most logical place to start here. Kevin O'Connell shouldered the responsibility. He says he has to get Dalvin Cook more involved. They have to run the football. No, I know score and situation obviously got Minnesota away from their comfort zone early, but at the same time, I mean, this was a one-dimensional attack, and as we've seen, when you can generate pressure, pin your ears back, and come after Kirk Cousins, the results are rarely in a positive fashion.
Yeah, this is one of the larger moves week to week, right? Vikings were an 8-point favorite on the look ahead. The Lions dominate Washington, especially early on in that half, where Detroit's defense held Washington to a 14% success rate in the first half. Then Cousins goes out and throws up all over himself in primetime again Monday night, and now we're sitting as low as 5.5 this morning. There's a few things that will determine this matchup. And while O'Connell's saying all the right things, because you do need to get Dalvin Cook involved, and he looked disinterested at times, so far there's been two data points. That's it. Aaron Glenn and the Detroit Lions are playing the highest rate of man coverage in the league. This is a little different than what they did last season. It's a pretty dramatic shift, and my assumption is the Lions secondary was too banged up last year to play the style Aaron Glenn truly wanted, because you think about him as an actual player, New York City with the Jets, he was, you know, press corner, bump and run, he was aggressive, he would, you know, take some gambles. But I think this is something to look for in this matchup with the Lions playing man, because Kirk Cousins has been an absolute animal against man coverage. In 2020, Cousins and the Vikings were number one in EPA per pass attempt against man coverage by a pretty wide margin. Last season in 2021, Cousins and the Vikings were number two in EPA per pass attempt against man, and we're thinking about less creative offenses the prior 2 years, right? The second element here is the blitz. The Lions have blitzed at a top five rate, sent the house on 38% of dropbacks. Through two games, the Packers and the Eagles defenses have gotten pressure on Cousins 47% of the time they've blitzed, and Cousins has a 16% turnover worth the play rate when blitzed so far. Just 3.5 yards per pass attempt to 51 passer rating. So there's going to be some things within this matchup that I think highly dictate the outcome. If you get Aaron Glenn playing high rates of man, I think the Vikings offense is going to have some real success here. If he comes out, plays soft zone, sends a bunch of blitzes, maybe that's the better formula for them. We'll see what that looks like. But I think the other thing here worth mentioning, and you know, I'm not really a trends guy. We talked about this off air a little bit, and I don't like them, but when sometimes they make sense and you can kind of unsee them, you know, you can see them unfold kind of in your mind, and you're like, okay, that makes a little bit of sense. The Minnesota Vikings have done extremely well at home after a road loss. The Vikings have such a home field advantage that I think sometimes when they hit the road, they're a little bit overpriced. They get in some different confines where they're outdoors. They inevitably lose these games like they did on Monday night. And we mentioned in that preview, the Vikings defense gives up about 5 more points per game on the highway. And then all of a sudden, Minnesota comes back home after the loss, and they're now underpriced while being aided by one of the best home field advantages. So this is really a good spot, I think, for the Vikings when you think about that reduction in price week over week and then the spot that they're in. So I'm really intrigued by this. I think a lot of people are probably surprised we're breaking down this game in week three when you have a matchup between two teams that combined to win 11 games last year. But this, to me, is one of the more intriguing matchups here.
Lions also dealing with an injury on the defensive line, in my opinion, that's not getting enough attention. And Lions defensive line coach, along with Dan Campbell, have heaped nothing but praise on John Kaminsky when you look at what he's been able to do in terms of generating pressure, opening up rush lanes for Aiden Hutchinson, talking about how massive a loss it could potentially be, suggesting that Isaiah Buggs and Alan McNeil have to be that much better as run stuffers and try and generate a little bit of pressure in known passing situations. On the other side, when you look at this Lions offense, it's arguably one of the biggest surprises early on in the season. Jared Goff looks extremely comfortable doing what he does, gets the ball out of his hands quickly, leaning on a talented tandem of backs in DeAndre Swift and Jamal Williams. And of course, we've seen Amon-Ra St. Brown, who we highlighted on the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly on Monday, put up absolutely outstanding numbers. You mentioned that Vikings defense, and I think it led us perfectly where we need to go. They're better at home than they are on the road. I've watched this group now for 2 weeks. You highlighted the fact that you thought there was a little bit of tomfoolery going on in the numbers they were able to put forth against Green Bay, and we saw them get fully exposed in the first half against Philadelphia before the Eagles never really felt threatened or a need to keep their foot on the accelerator in that second half.
Yeah, you're spot on there. And I think the other element to this is where you led us initially with the Lions offense and kind of how it's looked and how it's been reshaped a little bit. I think the one thing, if you listen to or read any piece of betting content this offseason, we were probably the only one that really highlighted Ben Johnson. And he took over as the passing game coordinator last season, and that's when the Lions offense started to take off a little bit. Their passing numbers were really good once there was that transition of him, you know, becoming their passing game coordinator. And it's only two data points, so you don't want to overreact. And one of those samples is a horrific Washington defense that's certainly undermanned with some injury issues. But 71 points through two games. That's the first time since 1970 the Lions have scored 30 or more back-to-back games to start a season. And right off the bat, you can see like the two noticeable differences are Goff in the pace. Goff is pushing the ball downfield. He's ninth in attendant air yards. Last year, this is something we've really been bashing Goff about the last handful of years. It's the reason he's not in Los Angeles still. It was driving McVay nuts. But last year, Goff had the lowest ADOT of 38 qualifying quarterbacks. Only 25% of Goff's passes traveled beyond 10 yards. That was also the lowest rate in the NFL. So, ninth now in intended air yards. There's been this dramatic shift with Ben Johnson. The second thing is pace. Lions right now, number one in pace of play the first three quarters. So two huge differences to factor in, and that's why we're seeing some of these Lions totals get pushed over. And then with Goff pushing the ball a little bit more and throwing to all parts of the field, defenses aren't really able to squat the box right now and stop the run. So Detroit's currently seventh in EPA per rush. The Lions lead the league in explosive run rate, nearly 23% of Detroit's runs have been explosive, and I think that sets up quite well in this spot, because if you look at the Vikings defense, which you kind of alluded to, it was a little fugazi week one, they're 29th in EPA per rush allowed, and it kind of just starts up front, right? That Vikings defensive line has just been getting blown off the ball. They're dead last in adjusted line yards. They're 24th in run stop win rate. The Vikings just have not been able to stop the run, and if you kind of look at some of the injuries, you mentioned the key one on the defensive side of the ball. Offensively, it was a very good sign that Frank Ragnow returned to practice on Wednesday, so keep an eye out on that. We thought this was a Detroit Lions offensive line that was really one of the league's best. A couple guys had gotten injured last week. Ragnow again returned to practice on Wednesday, so very good sign. Two other injuries, though, that would allow the Lions to have more offensive success in this game that you need to just kind of keep monitoring from now till kickoff. Harrison Smith, the Vikings all-world safety, suffered a concussion, so he's got to go through that protocol. Wasn't at practice on Wednesday. Andrew Booth, the kid out of Clemson, he was also a DNP on Wednesday. So a couple guys in that secondary, a little banged up for the Vikings as well.
You know, such an interesting dynamic when you look at this Vikings team and how they say the mood and everything around the franchise has been changed. Well, ultimately, it's great when you beat your division rival week one, but you have to continue to hold serve, and we'll see if they can get back to some of their basics with a win against the Detroit Lions. in week three, a team that's obviously surprised some folks and continues to be point spread darlings going back to last season. If we're talking about the NFC North, though, no discussion is complete without mention of the Green Bay Packers. And the Packers will be on the big stage Sunday afternoon when they'll head down to the Gulf Coast of Florida to take on the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And this number has moved all over the place. Right now, you're looking at Tampa. We'll call them a one-point favorite. Total in the game, 42. Tampa did open as a full field goal favorite. It's been one-way traffic on Green Bay since that point. We also saw this total open at 45.5, widely available. The total was 47-48 on the look ahead. That number didn't reopen after you saw both these teams play their week two games. And the Bucs, they're seeking their first 3-0 start since 2005. When you look at Aaron Rodgers, an absolutely irrelevant stat, but one that's entertaining, so I'll choose to share it anyways. His last two trips to the state of Florida have resulted in a combined score of 76-13. Apparently, you don't have enough hallucinogens out there to keep the quarterback happy. Last two games in Florida were two of his worst four performances in his NFL career. And when you look at the headliners here, Brady and Rodgers will be the fourth quarterback matchup in NFL history with seven combined MVP awards between them. Each of the previous three involved either Peyton Manning against Tom Brady or Aaron Rodgers. Tom Brady has obviously gotten the best of Aaron Rodgers, posting a higher completion percentage, yards per attempt, and touchdown interception ratio, and a passer rating in the last four head-to-head meetings. The last time these two did battle against one another came in the NFC title game. The infamous Matt LaFleur, let's take a one-possession game to a one-possession game and not get the football back. Since Tom Brady went to Tampa Bay, these are the two quarterbacks leading the league in touchdown passes. So I lay all of that out to ask the overarching question, Payne. Does Tampa have enough healthy bodies offensively to put legitimate fear into a Green Bay defense that looked a lot more like a top five unit against the Bears than they did week one against the Minnesota Vikings?
To your point, second week in a row, if you were getting the look ahead under on Tampa Bay games, you've been pleasantly surprised. You mentioned that was in that 47.5-48 range on the look ahead, reopened 46 at Pinnacle, but everywhere else was pretty much 45.5, and that just got swallowed up. I think the element that we've seen, you know, part of this movement rather, right, like Packers and under that we've seen so far is the Buccaneers offense has been pretty much a mash unit, and it's caused them to completely get away from what's made them so successful with Tom Brady. You know, the early down pass rates have just come crashing down. The Buccaneers, I think, out of necessity, have ran the ball on early downs 51% of the time. That's 4% more than expected. We kind of told you to keep an eye on this, right? Now, I don't think it's all Todd Bowles doing. You look at what's kind of around Tom Brady right now. You're down your left tackle, Donovan Smith, who didn't practice Wednesday. You're starting a backup rookie left guard, a backup center who has also managed to find his way onto the injury report Wednesday. It's tough to pass as much as you'd like with that kind of protection to your blind side. And then the backup left tackle, Josh Wells, who was filling in for Donovan Smith, suffered a calf injury and won't play this week. So the Donovan Smith injury now becomes massive, because we have to monitor that. If he can fight his way back with the elbow injury at less than 100%, maybe he tries to do that. The understanding was it was a pain tolerance thing, but didn't play last week. But if he's not able to go, Tampa's now going to be on their third string left tackle against a Packers defense that leads the league in pressure rate. So there's something to think about there. Then you're dealing with some wide receiver stuff, right? Chris Godwin, hamstring. Russell Gage, the same. Julio Jones didn't practice with a knee. Now Mike Evans has been suspended for this week's game. And I think he's probably the most underappreciated wide receiver who never gets mentioned in anybody's top five or even top 10 receiver rankings. But
dude's a horse.
You look at, I mean, just unbelievable numbers. And then you look at Tom Brady with Mike Evans off the field. His completion percentage dips to 61%. The touchdown rate crashes to 4%. His yards per pass attempt plummet to 6.7 with Tom Brady during his Tampa Bay tenure when Evans is off the field. And remember, the last couple times Evans didn't play, Brady had guys like Godwin and Gronk and Antonio Brown. So with all of these injuries through two games, you're looking at an offense right now in Tampa Bay that's made it to the red zone on 4 of 24 offensive possessions. That's the third lowest rate in the league. Past the cluster mess here, Leonard Fournette is being limited most weeks in practice due to the volume he's getting in game. Fournette's got 50% of the Buccaneers' touches the first 2 weeks. He's not the most explosive guy. I'd expect that to continue with, you know, just a significant amount of running, knowing the Packers' run defense is outside the top 25 in line yards allowed, EPA per rush, and success rate allowed per rush. So these are the things that you're kind of all adding up to get a total that reopened 45.5 and is now 41.5. I think the perception is Aaron Rodgers versus Tom Brady. How could you have a total this low? And this is the reasoning why. Now, ultimately, I think it probably ticks back up as you see this being one of the most popular 4 o'clock games. I know the networks rushed in a bidding war to go after this game. And so the public's going to be betting this thing, and they're just going to look at that total and be like, Rodgers, Brady, total 41.5. So it wouldn't stun me if it starts to tick back up a little bit after the initial massive wave from professional bettors going under.
How concerned should we be about this Green Bay run defense? Obviously, it was their Achilles heel last year. They went out and tried to address that this offseason. And I know game script, hey, look, if the Bears want to run it down 17 points, you're more than happy to let David Montgomery continue to pound the rock.
Yep.
But at the same time, you're giving up 8 yards per carry. It's not like his yards per carry went from 4 to 6 or something along those lines. They were major chunks to pick up. And if the Bears are able to execute inside the red zone, that suddenly becomes a one-score game. So do you feel Green Bay has done enough to address that, or do we kind of take it as a week-by-week approach and see what it looks like in a matchup here where you know they may be able to control the trenches against a lot of second stringers for Tampa Bay?
By nature, this is very much a coverage-style defense. That's how it's built, right? You play with five guys in the secondary, and your hope is that with Aaron Rodgers and an offensive mind like LaFleur, you're building leads. And then teams have to pass into your strength. But when games are tight and you're not built that way and Kenny Clark isn't necessarily playing to the level you thought as a run defender, and you know your early round draft pick out of Georgia is not producing at the rates that you thought he would, you're going to get gashed on the ground a little bit. So it's not surprising based upon the production of some of the high paid guys or guys that they've spent a bunch of draft capital on. And then the style was not necessarily conducive to being just like a stout run defense to begin with.
Yeah, very similar model that we've seen teams employ with relative levels of success in the past when you have an elite quarterback. The Indianapolis Colts did it years ago with Dwight Freeney, knowing that they were going to play with a lead. The key for them was getting a pass rush when teams were playing from behind, and very similar to what the Kansas City Chiefs have done over the last handful of years, neglecting their run defense in an effort to try and fortify some of what they can do from a pass defense standpoint. On the other side of the ball, for all the questions we have about Tampa offensively and their struggles, the defense has passed its first two tests with flying colors. And you dig into some of their numbers, they've shown teeth, allowing an NFL low 13 points so far this season, the third fewest through two games in franchise history. The fewest allowed through three games was 22 points going back to 2003. The only touchdown they've allowed so far this season came in garbage time against the Saints. They racked up 6 sacks and 5 takeaways. There was a stretch in that game where 4 of those turnovers came in a 9-play span that completely flipped that game upside down. The pass rush absolutely dominated the Saints. 6 sacks, 9 quarterback hits, Shaq Barrett, a man possessed. Devin White, who you've widely said can be a liability in coverage, but when he's able to play downhill, can be one of the more disruptive forces. Unfortunately for White, Green Bay has a tandem of backs that are more than happy to catch balls in the flat and turn 3 to 4 yard gains into big time plays, knowing that Green Bay still have some questions that need to be answered as far as the receiving core is concerned.
You're spot on. That is one of the matchup advantages that Green Bay has, getting Aaron Jones out there on Devin White. Even AJ Dillon has improved as a pass catcher. But I don't always love talking about games that move this much off the largest key number because it seems obvious to some. And past the players that are going to be out for the Buccaneers that we mentioned already, the bigger reason this game's moved is the massive dichotomy in early down performance. The Packers offense, we kind of hinted at in our last breakdown there of the Vikings defense, that the Packers offense is a little bit better than what the scoreboard is indicating. Third in success rate at nearly 53% in the first 3 quarters on early downs. The offense just is not as bad as is the perception. Aaron Rodgers in this offense bypassed third down on early downs 36% of the time. It's the highest rate in the league. And I get it. So far, it doesn't look great against the Vikings and Bears defenses. And those might not be great caliber defenses. But this is really interesting to me because Green Bay has just shown, and also, right, why this is coming down a little bit is I think Green Bay wants to run the ball here. They've been very lopsided in terms of early down run rate, right? They've also been pretty efficient doing it. Top four in both EPA per rush and rushing success rate. You got Elkington Jenkins back. He's got a game under his belt. That's an area where, shockingly, the Buccaneers haven't been very good this season, which is just kind of uncharacteristic of what we've seen from Todd Bowles Bucs defense the past few seasons. This was, you know, ultimately the premier run stopping defense. But small sample, so you're probably annoyed of that line from us so far, but that's really the gist of this through two data points. And you want to take some of this with a grain of salt, but Tampa's dead last and rushing success rate defense on early downs the first three quarters. 58% of runs have graded successful against Tampa, and now Akeem Hicks is out with a foot injury. He's supposed to be the Buccaneers' best run stuffer. That's what he was brought in to do. So I think not just Aaron Jones catching balls out of the backfield against Devin White, but I think there's going to be an ability here for Green Bay to have some success on the ground unless the Buccaneers' corners feel really good placed on islands and you can kind of put more guys into the box. In terms of this total, you know, we peaked at 46 on the reopen at Pinnacle and DK. 45.5 was the widely available number. The 41.5 is just kind of this lack of availability. I think when I look at this, though, and you just kind of see the overarching offenses on both sides, I think we expect lots of high run rates in this game. I really do. And both of the units have been successful running the ball. I'm just shocked when you have LaFleur, and he's been, you know, pretty run heavy, more than I thought he would be when he got to Green Bay, especially paired with Aaron Rodgers. And you think about Aaron Rodgers, Green Bay's 4% below expectation in early down pass rate. So they've been a run first team, and they're getting healthier along the O-line, and Rodgers is still kind of getting acclimated to his new receivers, although he did spread the ball around a good amount last week. But the other element here is the Packers are 31st in pace. This is clearly what LaFleur wants to do. This is how he operated last season when they finished dead last in pace. So you're talking about a slow pace for the Packers. You're talking about Tampa Bay flipping the entire script offensively, going to a run first team. The Packers being a run first team, and both defenses having a little bit of an issue stopping the run. So that's kind of the mindset here on why this total got hit under.
I'll take the low hanging fruit here and ask a question that I'm sure a lot of our listeners have as well. Knowing that you've missed the opportunity to potentially grab Green Bay as a 3-point dog, you never want to take the worst of it. Safe to say that the only way to approach the Packers, as long as you're able to get them up to the key numbers of 3, 4, 6, and 7, maybe as a viable teaser leg here?
It's a good question, and certainly it's a little bit different than this morning when Green Bay was +1.5 at a bunch of places and you could have used a traditional 6-pointer to get you through the 3 and the 7. I don't think it's a complete hindrance having to use a 6.5-pointer to get you through those key numbers, especially when you look at a total at 41.5. When you think about, at least from my knowledge, who is responsible for the originating move behind the scenes on the Packers +3, it would indicate very much that this is a strong position, and getting above that number on a teaser leg does make a bunch of sense. There are some nice matchups, as we mentioned. I think there's this perception of Green Bay's offense that isn't quite reality. Obviously, it's not as an explosive offense without Devontae Adams, but they do have some matchup advantages on this in this game with going on the ground and using Aaron Jones in the pass game. So that would make sense as a teaser leg, even at 6.5.
Pretty wild to think how much lower this total could even potentially be if Tampa and New Orleans don't play a game that's 20-10, when theoretically that game could have really ended 6-3 if it wasn't for turnovers late in that contest, and would have been one of the more defensive-minded games that we've seen all season long. Obviously not a far cry from when Tampa played New Orleans last year, and that game ended 9-0 with Tom Brady getting shut out. You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there as well. Most importantly, as always, follow the podcast at BetTheBoardPod for all of you that are already enrolled in our football free roll. Make sure you get those picks in. Even if you happen to miss a week, you still have available cash and prizes, swag packs, all sorts of good stuff. If you're able to go 5-0, typically what it takes, and be bang on with the tiebreaker. We know we have a very competitive field in that regard, and through the first 2 weeks, it doesn't suggest anything differently in terms of what overall win percentage it's going to take to win that thing. Sunday night football, Payne. Denver and San Francisco, arguably one of the most fascinating games of the entire week, maybe for all the wrong reasons, unfortunately. The 49ers have now moved into favorite territory. They're a 1.5-point consensus favorite throughout the market. This total, very fascinating. You see a low of 44 at some widely respected shops and a high of 45 at others. There have been 9 combined red zone trips in the 2 Broncos games so far this season. Neither the Broncos or their opponents have been able to come away with 7 points. Obviously, Nathaniel Hackett coming under fire for being the head coach and play caller hasn't exactly been the best with clock management. I refuse to throw the baby out with the bathwater despite his ineptitude through just 2 games. You did see the 49ers have a shift in their odds to win the Super Bowl with a change of quarterback. Unfortunately, Trey Lance lost for the season, but that didn't impact odds makers in a negative manner as the Niners have gone from that 25 to 28 range down to 20. Meanwhile, Russell Wilson, no stranger to playing the red and old gold, 17-4 straight up, 15-5-1 against the spread in his career versus the 49ers, includes the playoffs. He's been great in prime time against this team. What is interesting, for all the success that we used to heap on Russell Wilson and Pete Carroll when they played under the bright lights, some of that luster started to wear off in the twilight of their time together there. Russell Wilson just 2-9 against the spread his last 11 primetime games. Clearly, this Broncos offense isn't firing on all cylinders right now. Russell Wilson's completion percentage, nothing to write home about. Jerry Jeudy banged up, wasn't able to finish the game last week in their win against the Houston Texans. But the silver lining for Denver is they have 2 running backs that have been dynamic, highlighted by Javonte Williams. Unfortunately for them, running into the San Francisco defensive front may not be the recipe for success that the Broncos are looking for on Sunday.
Yeah, you know, just in general, Russell Wilson needs to be better. I know we're piling on Nathaniel Hackett, and for good reason, but Russ is still struggling a little bit. He's not taking what defenses are giving him. He's not throwing to all parts of the field. He's actually got the lowest rate of pass attempts between the numbers. He's still holding on to the ball for too long and hunting these deep shots, and it's led to a pressure rate above the league average against Houston, right? A defense with some question marks. Wilson had a completion percentage 12% below expectation, and obviously stepping up in class here against a 49ers defense. But I think what's interesting here is the perception, right? You'd be hard-pressed to find an offense and an offensive coaching staff getting bashed more than what's happening to Denver. And it's interesting because while they're in the process of learning this brand new system with a quarterback that doesn't necessarily mesh with this system, the offense is above average in schedule adjusted efficiency. And, you know, for all the stupidity and the negative red zone variance, the Broncos offense has actually been, you know, decent down to down, 14th. And then just on a generic yards basis, Denver's outgained its opponents by 296 yards, second most in the league. And I understand the competition hasn't been great with Seattle and Houston, but the production hasn't really been as bad, I don't think, as what you're hearing anytime you like Google Denver, turn on your sports television or your sports radio, whatever it is.
Oh, it cracks me up. It cracks me up right now. You think Denver was 0-2. You think that they'd have 7 total points offensively and every single metric would be rock bottom, both on the offensive and defensive side.
No, it hasn't looked great, right? The route concepts, you got running, you guys running into each other, and you know, the game management's been terrible and the play calling's been a little bit horrific. And you mentioned some of those red zone woes, right? 5 goal-to-goal situations for the Broncos, 0 touchdowns. 6 red zone trips altogether, 0 touchdowns. Gobs of procedure penalties, right? The Broncos have 25 penalties in 2 games, and that might be an hindrance with Sean Hockley calling this game, who averages about 15 called penalties per game. So not the great mesh of referee to, I guess, the correlation to what the Denver Broncos are doing offensively and the mistakes they're making. This isn't the referee that you want calling this game. I think the other thing here that's obvious, right? You got to get some of that stuff cleaned up. You're going to see an uptick in defensive production against the 49ers defense. And what I have seen from San Francisco is they've picked up where they left off last season, 4th in schedule adjusted defensive efficiency through 2 weeks. And if you remember exactly where this 49ers defense left off, obviously a loss to the Rams, but prior to that, they were stifling Nathaniel Hackett's Green Bay offense in the playoffs last season. The Packers were held to 36% passing success rate, 3.4 yards per carry, and just 1 explosive rush. And now all of a sudden you have a Nathaniel Hackett offense that includes him being a game manager and making decisions and not just calling plays, and a quarterback that's not really fitting this system all that well, learning it in game three. So if that's what's going to transpire at home with Aaron Rodgers, when you don't have that much on your plate, it's probably going to be difficult to see a ton of success here from Denver's offense. But, you know, again, this is also a step up for the 49ers as well. They've faced the Bears and Seahawks offenses, two of the worst in the league, and both of those games had some weather elements to them. So I think that's interesting here. Russ obviously has some familiarity against this 49ers defense, so he does know what to expect from that perspective, and he has performed better than expectation when you look at his splits, right, normalized versus the 49ers defense. He's been a little bit better than that median. This is interesting. Ultimately, I think it comes down to the number. We've seen early movement on the 49ers, much like you alluded to there, Todd, in the futures market. It's carried over to the weekly point spread. I believe most professional bettors are giving Jimmy G about a 2 to 3 point upgrade here. And I wouldn't say that's necessarily conservative. I think that's fair. We are going to see a higher floor with this offense. Now, again, as I kind of alluded to, the ceiling is not as high because Trey Lance just had way more talent and you could do different things in the ground game. But certainly the floor has been risen here, at least short term.
Well, you mentioned the ground game, and of course the 49ers continue to deal with a rash of injuries in their backfield. It's impossible to keep track of on a week-to-week basis who the Niners will actually have active other than Jeff Wilson, who's their designated starter. But Wilson has always shown some durability issues. We'll see, you know, which veterans can ultimately work themselves back into the fold. Tevin Coleman now there, Marlon Mack. They talked about a kid named Jeff Mason, I believe, should be their backup and active for this game. But more importantly, for this 49ers offense against a Denver defense that could be down one of its top cover corners in Patrick Surtain, George Kittle trending in the right direction, dealing with the groin injury, missed each of the first two games, and suddenly the 49ers now could have a trio of weapons in the passing attack that would allow them to attack Denver in space, with Brandon Ayuk putting up some good numbers, especially with Jimmy Garoppolo, and we know what the Swiss Army knife and Debo Samuel means to this team as well.
Yeah, I mean, and the other element here is Denver plays a ton of man coverage. And San Francisco is actually weirdly dead last in EPA per pass attempt against man. Now, both those data points have weather. Trey Lance is more than half the sample. But something to think about here a little bit. This is going to be a tick up for the Broncos defense, having, again, played Seattle and Houston's offenses. Kyle Shanahan is certainly more competent than that. You mentioned George Kittle trending towards playing. I think that's a huge get back when you think about the Broncos defense struggling to defend tight ends this season. Doesn't help that Josie Jewell and Justin Simmons are banged up in the middle of the Broncos defense either. Simmons is on the PUP. Josie Jewell didn't really practice that much on Wednesday. Patrick Surtain, you mentioned, left with a shoulder injury against Houston, was immediately announced out. They're happy with the diagnosis. I thought it would be much worse than it was. I still don't know if that means he's going to play this week. Has not practiced yet. Keep an eye on that. DJ Jones, the league's number one run stuffer last season, number one again through two games in run stop win rate this season. He's battling an ankle injury. Hasn't practiced yet this week. I know he wants to get out there against his old team. Randy Gregory dealing with a knee injury. So you want to check that Broncos injury report on the defensive side from now until kickoff. I think we talked again briefly about this game Monday, and I keep coming back to the spread because that's ultimately what matters, the price here. And we have seen this movement on the 49ers. And I just think Jimmy G is a substantially better quarterback right now than Trey Lance. But I do see an element here where if this were to get to three somehow, that we're going to see sharp professional money on the Denver Broncos. And even if it doesn't get to three, I think the plan is navigated a little bit differently, and suddenly you're looking at Denver being a nice teaser leg at home through the 3 and the 7 with a total that's in the mid to trending a little bit lower 40s. And I think that can make some sense. This total to me, Todd, is a little interesting in that our model saw value in the under, but I understood the perception of Jimmy G being an upgrade, guys getting back healthy, specifically Kittle for the 49ers offense, Denver having some injuries to deal with on the defensive side. Horrific variance in the red zone and goal to goal situations that even if you continue to be inept, have to progress a little bit. And so I understood this. And this is the second week that we've seen money on the Broncos overs, although once it got to about 46 last week against Houston, that took very, very sharp under money. I'm a little surprised we got to 45.5 here. And this morning, we're now trending back towards 44.5 a little bit. Any inclination on your viewpoint here with this total?
You know, it's so interesting because to your point, Denver has moved the football up and down the field. They've bogged down in the red zone. So I can understand the expectation that there's going to be variance and regression in a positive manner. Meanwhile, San Francisco on the other side, look, let's see what the game plan is with Jimmy G out there. We know this isn't a team that wants to go up and down the field and try and beat you scoring into the mid-30s. They're more than content to run the football, and I think if DJ Jones is out to anchor the middle of that Broncos offensive line, you could see the 49ers try to put together long marches that'll take 6 to 7 minutes off the clock. If you settle for field goals, it puts you in a little bit of a more difficult predicament, but so much of what we talk about early in the year when you only have a couple of games under your belt is all about perception, and right now I think Denver offensively is at rock bottom. So I wonder if this total were to come back down, dip below the key of 44, if you'd have an increased appetite again to go over the total, thinking that Russell Wilson is familiar with what the 49ers want to do defensively, and maybe seeing a familiar opponent on the other sidelines is what allows him to help break out of the slump he's shown at least through the first two games.
Yeah, that makes sense. Just a difficult game for me. I don't have anything on it right now. The numbers don't jive with me right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's two teams that we have a lot of questions about. I mean, Denver was all the buzz that, hey, they finally got themselves a franchise-changing quarterback, and Russ has looked anything but the part early on. Now, he hasn't had his full complement of weapons. We'll see if KJ Hamler's available to go. All the talk in preseason camp, and I never quite believed it, was that Russ was on the same page with Tim Patrick, and Patrick could potentially emerge as a true number one. Of course, he has a season-ending injury. You can see Cortland Sutton and Russ starting to build in the right direction. Jerry Judy not being out there changes a little bit of what's going on there. And as far as this 49ers team, hey, six straight regular season games they've played where they've held their opponents under 300 yards of offense. You talked about Nathaniel Hackett being completely bottled up by the San Francisco defensive front with his offensive concepts. Obviously, some weather in the forecast there at Lambeau during the playoffs. But it's a huge chess match. I mean, Russ and Nathaniel Hackett against this 49ers defense, I think for all the football nerds in us, is going to be the matchup that could highlight maybe the entire weekend, not just in the Sunday Night Football standalone type spot.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't really have much else on this game.
So, five games broken down as extensively as we know how around these parts, and as we continue to wrap up some of the Sunday slate, seeing even more Pittsburgh Steelers money come flowing into the market as 4.5s pretty much have disappeared, at least locally out here in the desert. Not a lot of other major line movement early this morning other than a slight tick up between the Saints and Panthers from 40.5 to 41. All right, my friend, we've broken down the biggest matchups, but not always the best spots to identify where we can go and find a little bit of value at the window this weekend. What have you identified us for an actionable element?
I think we go to the late slate, 405 Jacksonville and the Los Angeles Chargers. Let's go under in the first half, 24. That is right now the widely available number. If you have access to DK and FanDuel and others, that's the prevalent number there. I've been really... I think this Chargers defense is really good. And I'll just be candid. Like, we're going back to the well. We played the under on Thursday Night Football against the Chiefs, a better offense. And I just like what I'm seeing from this Chargers defense. Brandon Staley has those guys playing well. There's no holes anywhere. J.C. Jackson returned, played virtually every snap, did get burned, but it's his first game back. And supposedly he's a little bit sore, but he'll be out there. I think when you look at this matchup defensively for the Chargers, there's some advantages there. Jacksonville traveling across the country in an unfamiliar spot. Then the biggest thing here, obviously, is Justin Herbert. All signs point to him going. But at what rate? Everything we're hearing from guys that we trust, he's going to be about 70 to 80% health-wise. And already what you're kind of hearing is that he's not going to take off and run. that he's going to throw a little bit more shorter routes. I don't know if that's humanly possible. I think
Can you do that in the current constructs of the Chargers offense? I mean, everything would have to be behind the line of scrimmage for that to work.
I think that's the other element here is the perception of the Chargers offense is a little bit different than what we know it to be and our listeners know it to be, as we've kind of uncovered all of the short passing and not really letting Herbert uncork it downfield. Jacksonville, to me, offensively, certainly is the perception of Doug Peterson, and the offense is better. It does have a little bit better clue, but we still see Trevor Lawrence going through some lulls from time to time. But that defense, they spent some money there, spent some early draft capital there. Jacksonville right now, and I know they're not the best offenses in Washington and the Colts, but third in defensive efficiency. The Chargers, seventh in defensive efficiency. So you got two top 10 units here. And so I think this makes a lot of sense to potentially get out ahead and grab the 24 in the first half and go under in Jaguars Chargers.
Like the angle. Let's hope for a check down, Charlie. 8 to 9 minute drives that hopefully end in turnovers inside the red zone. Worst case scenario, kick some field goals. Keep that clock moving as we root for points to be at a premium at SoFi Stadium. A game where I'm not sure either fan base will be prominently represented in any capacity. You can follow
up. Also saw Pipkins and Corey Linsley, starting center, right tackle combination for the Chargers, exit last week's game. They were limited on Wednesday. If they play, they won't be 100%. If they're out, bonus for this as well.
And the one thing about this Chargers offensive line, I know Rashawn Slater gets all the pub about being the linchpin, and he has obviously exceeded expectations through a little more than his first season. You look at how much differently that group operated in hostile territory against the Chiefs without Corey Linsley. The protection schemes broke down, and on, you know, some level, that's what led to Justin Herbert getting hit not once but twice, creating that cracked cartilage in his ribs, a situation that I'm sure the Chargers don't want to have to deal with again, knowing that they could be able to check down, move the ball effectively through Austin Eckler and the ground game on top of it. You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Again, most importantly, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. Payne, any other nuggets, words of wisdom, gems that you would like to share with our audience before we embark on a 72-hour binge of watching football and reconvene Monday morning to highlight everything we saw transpire in the National Football League?
I don't know what just happened there, but I'm a little foggy this morning, didn't sleep overly well. And then you just said that line of a 72-hour football binge, and I just got happy.
See, there we go. Look at me.
Happy me is here.
Look at me, the model podcast of positivity. I know when we wrap these podcasts up on Thursday, it is the highlight of your week. I'm going to peel back the curtain a little bit for our listenership, because it is a labor of love, but it is extremely intensive to try and get these things out there. So appreciate all of you guys, our loyal listeners, for tuning in to each and every show, both on the college football and NFL side. I want to encourage you, if you just listened to the NFL, go back and listen to the college podcast. If you're not a huge NASCAR fan, well, that shouldn't be a reason not to listen to our Stay Green podcast that's also available on Fridays, where we offer up a best bet track side. And with only 4 games on the late slate on Sunday, flip on over, watch a couple of steel ponies going around the track while you're cashing that first half under in Jacksonville and the Chargers. For Payne,
steel ponies. You'll learn something new
every now and again.
I hadn't heard that.
You got to push the envelope.
I heard that
before.
I like that. Yeah, I like that.
For Payne Insider, I'm Todd Furman. Best of luck this weekend with all of your investments across all sporting disciplines, and with the Jaguars Chargers first half under ticket in hand, we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.